The Guardian.
Hello, Ian Sample here. And before we get started with today's edition of Science Weekly, I'd like to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For more about building beautiful websites, go to squarespace.com. And now, on with the show.
Maybe we're making too boring an assumption. Maybe not all the dark matter is the same.
By the end of this year, we will actually know the answer as to whether or not there is a dark matter disk in the Milky Way or not.
This week, we look at the science of uncertainties, taking in meteoroid impacts and gravity, to ask what role dark matter might have played in the demise of the dinosaurs. Joining me in the studio is Lisa Randall, theoretical physicist at Harvard University and author of Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs, and Malcolm Fairbairn, physicist at King's College London. Down the line is Jerry Gilmore, professor of experimental philosophy at the University of Cambridge. Welcome to you all.
Hi.
Thank you.
First off, perhaps before we get going on dinosaurs, we better actually discuss what we mean by dark matter. Malcolm, can you enlighten us? What do we mean by dark matter? What is this stuff?
So dark matter is some stuff which we think is flying around that we can't see because we can't bounce any photons off it. And we think it's there by looking at the way that galaxies rotate and by looking at the way that galaxies fall around each other inside clusters of galaxies and by looking at the way that the universe expands. So there seems to be a component of matter which is flying around. It's not made of protons and neutrons and electrons. It's made of something else and we can't see what it is.
The term dark, what do you mean by that? I think people get stuck on that.
Is because it doesn't interact with electromagnetism. So when I can see you, the reason I can see you is there's photons coming from the lights in this room that are bouncing off your face and then coming to my eyes. And they're bouncing off your face because you're made of protons and electrons and they interact with photons. But this dark matter, it doesn't interact with photons, so we can't see it.
But you said it does interact with normal matter in some ways.
Certainly gravitationally. So it affects the way that stars move around galaxies and the way that galaxies move around each other. It has gravity. Everything interacts with gravity, we think. So,
Jerry, you've been working on dark matter for many years. What do we know about how it's distributed in the universe and how do we know that?
Yes, so let me just sort of say first, a much better name would be transparent matter. Dark matter is certainly there. It knows about gravity. But it doesn't know about electricity, and so it's not dark, it's transparent. Fortunately, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to see very far through the universe, because there's a lot of it. But the existence of dark matter associated with galaxies was first discovered in the early 1960s, almost single-handedly by a guy named Morton Roberts, who was a pioneer of radio astronomy, and was able to measure how fast galaxies are spinning. You can do the same sort of experiment, and I first did it with some colleagues in the late 1980s and produced, in fact, the first precision measurement of how much dark matter there is near the sun. And essentially, it's a pressure-gravity trade-off. If you measure how fast something, our sun, for example, or stars in the Milky Way are moving, and also how they're spread out, then just using mathematics, it was in fact invented by Arab astronomers back in the 6th and 7th century, with basically Newtonian gravity, it's very easy to work out how much mass there must be, providing the force to hold those stars where they are. Essentially, if the star's moving fast, you need more mass. So when you do that experiment on the way the sun is moving around our Milky Way, for example, you discover that about a half the force holding our sun into the Milky Way comes from normal matter, the stars and the planets and the gas and the dust and so on. And the other half comes from this mysterious dark stuff. Then the next thing you want to do is say, well, how is this stuff distributed? That's very hard to do because you need ultra-high precision data. Certainly for our Milky Way, the reliable measurement, which was the one I first did 30 years ago, is how much mass there is in a column through the Milky Way. So we can measure that quite accurately, and the number hasn't changed since then. Actually, the number, if you work it out in terms of, imagine a galaxy squashed flat into a sheet of paper, the surface mass density, amazingly, works out at 80 grams per square meter, precisely the same as a standard sheet of everyday paper. That's how much our Milky Way galaxy weighs, if it were one sheet of paper thick. But it's much harder to say in detail how the matter is distributed in three dimensions. So we have some information on that, which suggests that most of the dark matter is distributed on sort of galaxy-sized scales. But that doesn't tell us about all of it. And in fact, it's not even the very interesting thing. The interesting thing is what happens on small scales. And on small scales, we know two things. The one is that we know roughly the amount of dark matter there is near the Sun, and the number is equivalent to about a third of a proton per cubic centimetre. So it seems sparse, but because it's everywhere, it adds up to a lot. The other thing we know from very small galaxies is that there's a deficit of it on small scales. And this is probably a clue to one of the points that Lisa Randall has emphasised, that there's probably lots of different sorts of particles in dark matter. But the puzzle on small scales is that we don't see it packed into very small volumes based on current evidence. But the current evidence is far from straightforward, and it's all complicated. There's always a but in this subject. It's always complicated by astrophysics. And so it's possible that the dark matter set itself up in the early universe in some particular distribution, and then all the supernova explosions and mess that happened since have pushed around a bit. And so we don't know very reliably how dark matter is distributed on small scales, but we know most of it is distributed smoothly on large scales.
And so, Lisa, Jerry just touched on it there, that one of the things that you propose in your book, in fact, at the heart of your book, one could say, is the idea that there is more than one kind of dark matter out there. Can you talk me through that idea a bit? Why do we think that there's potentially more than one kind of dark matter?
So first of all, I want to say that the heart of the book is really the story of cosmology and the story of the solar system and within the galaxy and even life on Earth. I mean, that's really what the book is, and that's what most of the book covers. My theory, of course, is a way of framing it and sort of telling a scientific story that surrounds it. We don't know yet how dark matter is distributed, as we just heard, but if you do simulations, you find that it's pretty much a spherical halo around the galaxy.
Perhaps we could just talk about what we mean by halo. So
we really mean just a cloud. Mm-hmm. I mean, we really just mean that it's mostly in a spherical distribution mm-hmm. around the galaxy. Whereas ordinary matter is concentrated in the Milky Way plane, which you see mostly when you get outside of London, and you see this bright stripe of stars and gas that's emitting light. But the rest of the galaxy, which really is dark matter, is probably not concentrated that way. It's more spherically distributed. Mm-hmm. We don't know for sure because we haven't measured it all, but if you do simulations, that's pretty much what it looks mm-hmm. like. But what we propose, and we propose it in part because it's interesting and in part because it can be tested. There really are observations now looking in some sense at what the gravitational potential of a galaxy is. And what we propose is that maybe we're making too boring an assumption. Maybe not all the dark matter is the same. We know that most of the dark matter doesn't interact with ordinary matter. And we also know it has actually very sparse interactions even with itself. We know that because we can make observations that show that dark matter just passes through itself mm-hmm. in clusters of galaxies, for example, which are gravitationally bound sets of systems of galaxies. What we propose is that maybe a fraction of the dark matter, not most of the dark matter, but some small part of the dark matter, actually has additional interactions. It's more like ordinary matter in that mm-hmm. sense. And so that fraction of the dark matter might even have its own charge, its own light. We know that dark matter doesn't experience the light of ordinary matter. Maybe dark matter has its own light that ordinary matter doesn't experience. And if that's the case, it too can collapse into a disk like the disk of the Milky Way. Mm-hmm. The Milky Way is formed because ordinary matter can radiate, mm-hmm. and therefore it can collapse into a disk. And maybe some small fraction of the dark matter does the same thing. And the only way to really know whether this is the case or not is to figure out the consequences and go out and look for them. And that's what we're proposing should be done.
Can I just make sure I've got this right? If dark matter did radiate its own form of radiation, this would be called dark photons. We wouldn't be able to see that, right?
That's absolutely right. It would be as invisible to us as ordinary photons are to dark matter. And if you think about it, if, you know, dark matter people had looked at ordinary matter and said it was just one kind of particle, they'd be pretty badly wrong. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying maybe we're making it too simple an assumption too, and maybe dark matter is a little more complicated than we think.
Malcolm, are you keen on the idea of there being more than one kind of dark matter?
Absolutely. I think the idea that the dark sector could be a lot more complicated than we've considered before is something that's definitely worth thinking about. If we look at protons and neutrons, we're familiar with all the different elements, and they've got different binding energies. So we know that we can do fusion with hydrogen, and we can do fission with uranium. and they either give out or they take in energy when they do these things. And dark matter could be exactly the same. We know that dark matter probably doesn't have any long-range forces, or if it does have long-range forces, they're quite weak.
Or a fraction of the dark matter can have a long-range force.
Right, or a fraction of the dark matter. Most of the dark matter can't have a long-range force, because if it did have a long-range force, then it would have viscosity and things, and it would redistribute itself, and then it wouldn't solve the problems that it does solve. Mm-hmm. Like, it would redistribute itself just like the protons and the neutrons have into sort of smaller mm-hmm. galaxies. But there's no reason why it can't have very complicated short-range forces, or some fraction of it can have a long-range force. Mm-hmm.
Jerry, are you also on board with the idea of there being more than one kind of dark matter?
Yes, actually, but not only from the sort of simplicity, you know, the universe isn't that simple, but also for a good historical reason based on 20th century physics, and that each time there was a really big advance in unifying basic physics, elementary particle physics, the answer turned out to be some new theory and a new particle. So, for example, when electricity and magnetism were combined by Maxwell, a new particle, the photon, was involved, and so on all the way down through the exotic things to the most recent example where mass was put into particles and we discover the Englert-Higgs mechanism and, hey presto, the Higgs boson, which was found. And so whenever a really big question is answered, part of the answer seems to be an elementary particle. And fundamentally, there is more than one really big question that we still haven't answered, like why does time go forward, why is the universe matter and not antimatter, and so on and so on. And my expectation from history is that each of the answers to those big questions will correspond to a new class of elementary particles, which will be the dark matter particles. So there's lots of questions, so there's probably lots of particles.
So one reason we're excited about our research is this gives a way to actually test this proposal. You know, it seems like such a simple idea that the dark matter sector should have more than one particle, but it's been amazingly unexplored. And so by proposing this, it you know, we have these big data sets that, you know, right now measurements and observations are expensive and take a long time. You really want to get as much information out of those as you can. So one of the reasons we do model building, which is to say to propose examples like this, is to give targets to look for, because these things are subtle and you won't find them unless you know what to look for. And so that's one of the motivations behind the kind of research that I'm doing.
One of the implications of this potential disk of dark matter is that it could affect the motion of our solar system as we go around the galaxy. So am I right in saying, so we kind of pass up and down through the galactic midplane as we go around the galaxy?
That's right.
So what would dark matter do? How does that have an effect?
Well, first of all, there would be more matter in the plane, which means that the restoring force, the force that the reason it bobs up and down is that the plane of the galaxy pulls it back up again if it goes down, and it pulls it back down again if it goes up.
Like it being on a leash or something like that.
Or a spring.
Yeah.
And so it's pulling it back, and if there's more matter, it pulls it back more strongly. And so the period, that is to say the time between disk crossings, would be smaller. Mm-hmm. So, for example, without dark matter there, it would probably be about 55 or 60 million years based on the observed matter in the Milky Way disk. Mm-hmm. But with dark matter, it can be more like, well, it could be different, it could be shorter, it could be more like 30 million years, which is an interesting number,
I
as
see.
You know.
So it means that we cross, as we go around the galaxy, we're crossing up and down through that galactic midplane with a shorter time interval.
That's exactly right.
Okay. And what else would it do? There's this kind of idea about it having an influence on the Oort clouds. It's a good time to bring in the Oort cloud.
Right. So for that, you need to know a little bit about the solar system, and in particular, the fact that at the kind of what you might consider the edge of the solar system, the place where the sun is just barely gravitationally binding objects more strongly than other objects outside the solar system, is something called the Oort cloud. And the Oort cloud contains proto-comets, objects that are frozen, but if they came near the sun, would have volatile materials that would look like comets. Mm-hmm. And it's actually the source of long-period comets, comets whose period is longer than 200 years. Mm-hmm. These objects are orbiting, but they're weakly bound, which means that if there's even a small kick, you have the potential to send these objects either out of the solar system or hurtling towards the inner solar system, mm-hmm. where they have the potential to strike the Earth. And so what we propose is that there's, if this dark disk is dense enough and thin enough, you would see these episodic times when objects are more likely to be ejected from the Oort cloud. And at those times, they're more likely to hit the Earth.
Jerry, how much do we know about how often the sun... I mean, it seems to be a difficult thing to measure, how often the sun goes up and down through the galactic midplane. How do we measure that sort of thing?
Well, Lisa just pointed out, it's not easy to do. We can measure quite accurately the relative speed of the sun compared to all its neighbours in our part of the Milky Way, and we know that number very accurately. And from that, we can calculate the orbit. But you can calculate the orbit only if you know how the matter is distributed. So it's exactly right. Lisa was exactly right, is that we know the number under two assumptions. One is the assumption is that matter is the dark matter is distributed smoothly. And we know the number under a different assumption, which is the dark matter is distributed in some other way that you wish to specify. And that gives you the two answers, 60 million or 30 million years. So either may be correct. We don't know.
When it comes to the implications of this, I mean, are you saying that without this dark matter disk, there wouldn't be enough of a change in tug for these comets to be ejected from the Oort cloud, Lisa? Is that the kind of thing?
Well, to really create a difference in the rate at which they're ejected, you need the disk to be narrow. Mm-hmm. You know, people had proposed even that as it crosses the Milky Way, mm-hmm. it could eject objects from the Oort cloud. But even if it did so, it would do so rather smoothly. Mm-hmm. The density doesn't change enough. If you want to say that every 30 or 35 million years you have an enhanced probability, you need really some specific kind of spark, you know, some specific tug that happens only on those intervals. So you mm-hmm. need a narrow mm-hmm. disk, which is actually what dark matter can do if it's heavy enough.
And presumably this is where the dinosaurs come in.
Or they go away.
Or they make their great exit. So yeah. Perhaps you can explain to me, how does this tie in then with this idea of the dinosaurs? Extinction?
Well, again, this is speculative, but mm-hmm. we do know the thing that isn't speculative, and actually one of the joys of writing this book was really learning the story better, is that there really was an impact 66 million years ago. Mm-hmm. of an enormous object, 10 to 15 kilometers big, moving really quickly, like at least 30 kilometers per second. Mm-hmm. So that's an enormous amount of energy that hit the Earth. And it had a lot of consequences. And it happened 66 million years ago. We happen to have left the midplane a couple of million years ago, most likely. Mm-hmm. So if the period is around 32 million years, I mean, there's actually some give and take because mm-hmm. this is not a precise prediction. Mm-hmm. But if with that kind of period, which is about the right ballpark, that means that the one 66 million years ago could have been one of these impacts that came from the Oort cloud.
Malcolm, how do you feel about dark matter and dinosaurs being
Well, this idea that there's been periodic extinctions in the history, I read about it a very long time ago. I think I read about it first more than 20 years ago, and it's a fascinating idea. I think the data which suggests that there might have been periodic extinctions is quite sparse, but that's kind of inevitable. Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating idea. Perhaps we haven't made it clear enough that in order to get a component of the dark matter to form such a dense disk, mm-hmm. it really needs to lose some energy, whereas most of the dark matter can't. So you would, in order to get such a dense disk which could perturb these objects in the Oort cloud and get mm-hmm. them to hit the Earth as we moved through this mm-hmm. disk, you need some component of the dark matter which actually falls in and forms this very, very dense disk mm-hmm. along the plane of the galaxy.
Jerry, how can we test this? I know that there's a spacecraft called Gaia that's up there at the moment. Can you explain to me how that could help?
Okay. Gaia is the first ever precision survey of where stars are and how they're moving. So it will provide precise distances and three-dimensional speeds for 1.5 billion stars, whereas currently we know that information for about 500. Sort of embarrassing, really, after doing astronomy for so long that we know so little, but we're changing by orders of magnitude the precision with which we will know the way stars are moving. And in the way we've been discussing, once you know where the stars are and how they're moving, then you can do much, much more accurate studies of how the matter is distributed on different scales. So as I mentioned, up until now, we've only been able to do that by averaging over thousands of light years because we haven't had the precision information on where the stars are. But with Gaia, and the first data release is only 5 months away, we will be able to answer precisely this question to much higher precision. So by the end of this year, we will actually know the answer as to whether or not there is a dark matter disk in the Milky Way or not from the Gaia precision measurements.
I'm getting nervous.
I was going to say, you're excited about that, Lisa, but is it
it's
nervous?
Amazing. It's amazing to have the idea tested yeah. so quickly. I mean, one of the amazing things when we were writing this paper, you know, I'm a particle physicist, and, you know, the Higgs boson was 50 years from prediction to discovery. I mean, it's amazing the idea that this thing was launching that very fall and, you know, going to give us answers so quickly.
And so, Jerry, what is it exactly that one's looking at? Is it the speed at which stars are kind of bobbing up and down, or is it more than that that we're looking at here?
Well, Gaia's a sort of, actually, strictly speaking, it's 13 dimensions, but you don't want me to go into that right now. But for every star nearby, and in July or early summer this year, we will release the data for the nearest 2 million stars, and then 1.5 billion to follow over the years to come. But for every star, we'll know where it is and how it's moving. And so once you know where all the stars nearby are and how they're moving, then you've got six dimensions, you know, three of space and three of movement, which is essentially mass. So you've got a map, a high precision three-dimensional map of mass. And initially we'll do that for the several tens of light years around the sun. That will happen this summer. And then we'll move on out, all the way out to the center of the Milky Way over the next few years. But what we get, what Gaia gives you, is this precision information of where the stars are and how they're moving. And from that, we can deduce how the matter is distributed to much, much higher precision than we've been able to up until now.
So essentially, by looking at the motion of the stars, you can work out what the gravitational influence is acting upon them.
That's precisely correct. Yeah, you know, as I mentioned briefly before, if the stars are moving fast, it takes more mass to hold them where they are than if they're moving slowly. So when we know accurately where they are and how fast they're moving, it's not straightforward, but it's feasible to deduce how the mass is distributed. And so we'll know whether it's how much of it is in a thin layer or not. And whether that will actually be enough to make a definitive statement, I very much doubt, unfortunately, because theoretical physicists are extremely creative people, and they'll manage to keep us all interested waiting for future chapters in the saga.
Well, actually, one interesting thing that we're finding, but we actually looked at the Hipparchos data, and it looked like the sample stars that we were studying actually are moving slightly up and down, which means that it's actually a little bit harder to pin down the potential than we had thought.
Yeah, well spotted, actually. Yes, that's not many people have done that accurately, but I did too, yeah. But you're right, yeah. That's why I hesitated and said it's not a trivial situation, because it's all to do with how much things are in equilibrium. And in fact, there are big systematic trickles and warps caused by the fact that most of the stars are also in a thin disk. It's called the galactic bar. And so
we're not cheating. It's just we're really trying to actually interpret the data in terms of what it actually means.
No, I agree. It seems silly, but doing basic Newtonian mechanics on the motions of stars is actually right at the state-of-the-art limit of what we can do in experimental physics today.
Malcolm, are you excited about the release from Gaia that's coming up?
Absolutely, yeah. It'll tell us all sorts of things about the distribution of dark matter. And so that'll feed into all sorts of things, not only this, but it'll also make sure that our predictions about what we expect with direct detection experiments are correct, because it'll measure very accurately the local density of dark matter. Mm. So Gaia is a very important satellite, and the data is going to really help us understand the distribution of mass in the Milky Way like never before.
One of the things, before perhaps we move on with some other aspects of your theory, Lisa, is I just want to ask, is there anyone who doesn't really buy the idea of dark matter? I mean, I've read some ideas that some people say, oh, it's just a different kind of gravitational phenomenon. I mean, can you just give me a feel for that?
There's a theory called modified Newtonian dynamics where actually I've got a lot of sympathy for it, because if you go back to the history of how people derived Newton's laws of gravity, they looked at the motion of the planets. By looking at the motion of the planets, they figured out that there had to be this inverse square law of force. So if you extend that argument, that when you look at the stars going around the galaxy, if they're not doing what you expect them to do using Newton's law, then perhaps you should change the laws of gravity on those scales. But what we haven't done that, we've said, actually, no, Newton's theory, which is a limit of Einstein's theory of general relativity, but Newton's theory is accurate at those lengths. It's just that we have to introduce this dark matter. But the reason why we're particularly willing to do that is that dark matter doesn't only explain the stars going around galaxies, it also explains the motions of galaxies around each other. And also, if you want to understand how quickly the universe is expanding, if we only had the protons and the electrons that we were made of, then the universe would not be expanding as quickly as it is. So that also tells us that we need some extra stuff. So dark matter solves a lot of problems at the same time, whereas this modified Newtonian dynamics, or MOND, it only really solves things on one scale, on the scale of galaxies.
I mean, the other thing that gets lost a lot of the time when people talk about it is that it's actually far more radical to change the laws of gravity than to assume that there's this substance we don't see. I mean, it's really funny, since the Copernican revolution, you would think people are a little bit more humble about not being the center of the universe. But the idea that there should be matter that we're not made of, that we don't observe, I mean, it's a very simple concept. It's just particles that aren't charged. Mm. I mean, there's no reason they shouldn't exist.
In fact, it'd be a surprise if they didn't exist.
And I think so. I think the surprising thing is actually how much ordinary matter there is as a fraction of the universe. You might have thought the amount of dark matter was trillions of times bigger, yet it's only five times the amount of energy. And that's actually a really interesting puzzle. I mean, the other reason we think it really is dark matter is because it really looks like dark matter, in the sense that you can actually see objects like something called the Bullitt cluster, where clusters of galaxies, these are gravitationally balanced sets of galaxies, have merged. Mm-hmm. And you see the gas get stuck in the center and the dark matter passes through. Mm-hmm. It really just looks like matter. It's very hard to modify the laws of gravity to explain something like that.
Joey, presumably you also, with your long career in dark matter, you're also pretty sure it's out there.
Yeah, I am actually. Yeah. Now, I've written, done a lot of studies with colleagues trying to find ways of explaining the observations using alternative theories of gravity, and they always do less well than normal gravity with extra mass. And so the normal rational scientific method tells one that yes, dark matter is a real massive substance, and therefore because we don't see it in tight clumps, it therefore probably is elementary particles spread out rather diffusely. And so I think that's definitely the balance of probabilities right now. And I very much support Lisa's point about the Copernican principle. It's absurd to think that the universe should be made of the stuff that we happen to be made of. That's just arrogance.
And the response to your theory, Lisa, it's had some really interesting responses to it. But one of the things that people have said is, oh, you know, there's uncertainty in this idea of there being a new kind of dark matter. There's uncertainty in the idea of it forming a disk. And then there's also uncertainty in the crater record. Is that something that bothers you, the fact that there's sort of, it's hard to pin down this periodicity in the crater record?
Of course, we always want there to be more data. I mean, that's, you know, the world we live in. Like I said, I'm excited that there's as much data, or there will be as much data as there will be, to test the idea of a disk. Mm. I mean, we didn't set out to explain the periodicity. This is a nice byproduct. And so you could either stick your head in the sand and say, we're never going to look at it, or you can say, how much science can you do with the data that we have? And one of the really interesting things is Matt Rees and I did this work together. And when we read through the literature, it was amazing because, you know, there'd be one paper saying there's periodicity, one paper saying there's not. You know, it was really interesting to see the different statistical analyses that went into it. And one thing that's really interesting and important about having an actual model is, whereas a lot of the literature just said, can we match it to some period? That is to say, can we see that it happens at some regular basis? But of course, then it could be any number. Mm-hmm. And that reduces the statistical significance, because if you allow any possibility, something might look better than random. Mm-hmm. But if you have a model, if you actually know what the galaxy is made of, mm-hmm. then there's fewer possibilities. And that enhances the statistical strength mm-hmm. of whatever you find. It doesn't mean that it's necessarily present, but it does give you a way of doing a better analysis. So part of our goal was just to do a better analysis and to say, how do you test this idea? Of course, we would love if there was more information about craters, but the thing I do think will be tested is this idea of a disk. And one of the interesting things is, if you do believe this periodicity, it tells you what the density and roughly what the thickness should be for the disk. So that's something you can measure. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't bother me, because that's how we do science. We go forward, we make proposals, and then we test them. And the fact that I don't know the answer yet, I just find that exciting.
Sure. I mean, it does seem that the likelihood ratio, which, correct me if I'm wrong here, is sort of basically the chance of your model mm-hmm. yielding the data that we see compared to it being mm-hmm. random meteoroid impacts, for example. Mm-hmm. That's still quite a low number that you get out there. So it's not like it's fitting a lot better. It's fitting a little bit better than it being random.
That's right. It was about a factor of three.
Yeah.
And that's right. And so this is just an interesting sidebar in some ways. Mm. It's also an interesting sidebar that at least convinced me that it's really interesting to learn about this.
Yep.
So I learned a lot more, not just about periodicity, but, and this is what I'd like to share in the book, Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs, is, you know, to really share, you know, what I've learned about the rate at which asteroids and comets hit the Earth, what I've learned about, you know, the history of life on Earth. Could this have helped create life, and could it have helped, you know, what do we know about extinctions? I mean, it's not necessarily directly pertinent to the research, but it was a good excuse for me to go and put all this story together. So that, I think that was rewarding in and of itself.
Malcolm, are you always astounded by the connectedness of the universe as well? Is that something that's...
That's the reason I'm a physicist, the connectedness of the universe. Yeah, so it doesn't astound me anymore. But the nice
each
thing...
Each time you find something else, it's pretty exciting, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. But this theory, with the Gaia data, at least it's testable. So it doesn't really matter if you think it's crazy. I don't think it's particularly crazy. I've seen some pretty crazy things on the archive. But this one's testable, so that's really nice.
And Jerry, presumably you're just getting set here for the Gaia data release, and that's going to tell us quite a lot.
Well, yes. I'm the UK lead for the Gaia project, so I'm looking forward to what we can get out from the data. But it won't be trivial to interpret it, as we've mentioned. But I'm sure there's a great deal in there. And the combination of theories coming in from the elementary particle physics side and observations is the way scientific progress is made. You know, Lisa is an exceptionally intelligent person, and so you take her theories with seriously and test them against observations. You don't put your own preconceptions in the way, and we'll find out what nature is telling us quite soon.
Well, thanks for that.
Great. Well, we'll get to hold our breath now for the summer, I think. Thanks so much for joining us. And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Malcolm Fairbairn, Lisa Randall, and Jerry Gilmore. From me, Nicola Davis, and all the science team, thanks for listening.
Squarespace. This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you have many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design, so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.